Thank you, Lisa. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Garland versus Rowe.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Young will present argument for petitioner. He has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This court has said many times the language of a statute is the starting place for its interpretation, and often the ending place as well. We believe that the language of this statute affords the court many different opportunities to conclude that a cause of action for improper credentialing is a health care liability claim. We also believe that conclusion is reinforced by the traditional tests employed by Texas courts for a health care liability claim and by the policy of the statute. First, we believe that such a claim is a cause of action against a health care provider for treatment. Now, it is not disputed. The hospital did not actually treat Rose. But it is also undisputed that Dr. Fowler did treat her. And so the question becomes, is the cause of action against the hospital a cause of action for Dr. Fowler's treatment? The courts considering improper credentialing claims have analogized such claims to negligent entrustment or to negligent hiring. And in the case of both those causes of action, the misconduct, the acts or omissions of the entrustee are part and parcel of the cause of action against the entrustor. And so a cause of action for improper credentialing is a cause of action for the hospital's credentialing, but it is also a cause of action for the improper treatment to which that credentialing allegedly led. A cause of action encompasses duty, breach, and causation. And so the fact that the acts or omissions of which the hospital is accused are not themselves treatment does not mean that the cause of action against the hospital is not a cause of action for treatment. And there's nothing in the statute that requires that the cause of action be for treatment by the same health care provider as is the defendant in that cause of action. Second, we believe that this was a cause of action against a health care provider for a claimed departure from accepted standards of health care during the patient's medical care, treatment, or confinement. Again, Dr. Fowler unquestionably treated Ms. Rose during her medical care, treatment, or confinement. And his negligence, his departure from accepted standards, is part and parcel of the improper credentialing cause of action. The courts have held, if the physician is not negligent, was not negligent, then there is no improper credentialing claim. The only case that we have found from a jurisdiction whose statute includes this during the patient's care, treatment, or hospitalization language comports with this analysis, and that's the Winona Memorial Hospital versus Kester case out of Indiana. There the court said a claim for, under Indiana law, negligent credentialing is a claim for two sets of negligence, for negligence on the part of the hospital in credentialing the physician and for the physician's negligence. And those cannot be separated, and so a cause of action for negligent credentialing is a cause of action for malpractice occurring during the patient's care, treatment, or hospitalization. Thirdly, we believe this is a cause of action against a health care provider for a claimed departure from health care standards by the hospital itself during the patient's care, treatment, or hospitalization. We know that from looking at Rose's own allegations. Contrary to her brief in this court, in her petition, she alleged not a series of discrete pre-hospitalization events at which the hospital acted improperly, but a continuous process through which it acted improperly, continuing up to the moment of surgery. We were accused of entrusting the operating room to an incompetent physician, of failing to prevent him from performing the surgery, acts and omissions that may have begun earlier but continued right up through treatment. In any event, that is of the, whether that's alleged by the plaintiff or not in a given case, that is of the essence of the credentialing process. The credentialing process does not take place at discrete times. It is a continuous process. involving supervision by department heads, involving mortality, morbidity conferences, involving complaint and ombudsman procedures. That is a continuous process from the moment a physician is credentialed to the moment that he treats
a patient. Mr. Young, apart from the Indiana case, how many cases have been decided that hold, as you contend here, that this is a health care liability claim?
There are six apart from the Indiana case.
How many in Texas?
None one way or the other. There are a couple of cases holding that pre-admission acts or omissions by hospitals give rise to a health care liability claim. There's a negligent hiring of a nurse case and one other. We believe that the continuous nature of this process is analogous to the blood banking case out of the lower court in Virginia, Jappell versus Arlington Health Foundation. And there the court realized that blood banking is a continuous process beginning with the collection of blood from a donor and ending with the transmission of that blood, the transfusion of that blood into a patient. That the purpose of those earlier acts is to affect the later act. Here, the temporal linkage under the statute is not to the acts or omissions of the health care provider. That's the way the Court of Appeals analyzed this case. But rather, to the departure from accepted standards. Well, now, departure from accepted standards is a concept of duty and breach of that duty. The hospital's duty to Ms. Rose arose when she was admitted and a hospital-patient relationship was formed. The fulfillment of that duty may have depended on pre-admission acts or omissions. Just as a manufacturer has a duty not to distribute a defective product, but to fulfill that duty needs to properly design the product and properly manufacture the product before it distributes it. Nevertheless, the duty-triggering event is the distribution. The duty-triggering event in this case is the hospital admission. So,
does it concern you that the Texas Medical Practice Act precludes a hospital from practicing medicine? And if so, how do you address that?
I recognize that fact. I address it by saying that the statute has dual standards, one for medical care, which requires that it be done by a licensed physician, and one for health care. Hospitals do not provide medical care, but they very much do provide health care. In fact, let me go further, they provide treatment. The nurses and technicians may actually treat a patient, but more broadly, the hospital provides health care not only in its treatment of the patient, but in its provision of a facility and staff in which the physicians can do their work. The cases on direct hospital liability acknowledge a duty to have proper procedures, to have proper equipment, to provide a proper atmosphere where medical care by physicians can occur. And so when a hospital credentials a medical staff, and then when it later provides that properly credentialed medical staff to a patient, it is providing health care to that patient, even though it does not actually render the medical services. Finally, we believe that the cause of action fits as a cause of action against a health care provider for claimed departures from accepted standards of safety. This court in the DiversiCare versus Rubio case will be exploring exactly what that term safety means, whether it is limited to standards of safety within the healthcare industry, standards of safety that require expert proof. But in any event, that term includes no durational language similar to the other two terms. Now, what the Court of Appeals did was transplant the durational language from the statutorily defined terms into the undefined terms. And in doing that, it violated the statutory mandate, which this court acknowledged in the Horizon versus Ald case, that undefined terms in Article 4590I are to be construed according to the common law and by implication not according to the definitions of other terms. So safety, whatever its scope may be, does not include a durational element, and we believe the Court of Appeals erred in including one. Let me touch on the standard traditional tests employed by Texas courts for a health care liability claim. and there are essentially three. They overlap and are not completely distinguishable. Does it involve a healthcare standard of care? It's undisputed in this case that improper credentialing does involve such a standard of care. Does it require expert testimony? It's undisputed in this case that the cause of action will require expert testimony. Is it an inseparable part of the rendition of healthcare services? And this is the part that's drawn into question in the case. The fact of the matter is, physicians cannot practice in a hospital setting without being credentialed. Conversely, hospitals cannot function without credentialed physicians. So if healthcare, medical care, is to occur in a hospital setting, there must be credentialing. And not only is the credentialing a but-for prerequisite to the provision of healthcare, it is there's an essential linkage between the two. The purpose of credentialing, its entire function, its essence, is to ensure quality patient care by ensuring that only competent physicians provide that care. The patient care provided by the physician is where the rubber meets the road of the credentialing that took place earlier. And so we believe that the two are inseparably linked. That indeed is the rationale of many of the seven cases from other states cited in our reply brief, which reason that the provision of health care by licensed physicians, credentialed physicians, simply cannot be decoupled from the hospital's decision to credential those physicians in the first place. And so, for those reasons, as well as the policy reasons of the statute with which the court is well familiar, reduce the frequency and severity of healthcare liability claims, we believe that this claim fell squarely within the statute and that the Court of Appeals erred in holding otherwise. Unless the Court has any questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. The Court is ready for your argument from respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. J. English will now present argument for the respondent.
May it please the Court, again, I'd also like, previous counsel, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to be here. This is my first trip to argue before you all, and I'm only a little frightened, but thank you for allowing me to be here. Justice Phillips, in his dissent in Agbor, I believe, first articulated a request that with regard to negligent credentialing claims, there be some clarification from the Texas legislature, because it was very clear that the way the Medical Liability Insurance Improvement Act was written, that it was supposed to be limited only to health care liability claims. And so there's this inherent question over whether what we would think of as mixed questions of medicine and risk analysis, or medicine and business aspects running a hospital, like credentialing, can properly be held to be under the ambit of the Medical Liability Insurance Improvement Act.
But on this one instance, the legislature hasn't clarified
They have not clarified it, as you requested, now 8 years later. However, as you all, I'm sure, are familiar, there has been a thing called House Bill 4. In House Bill 4, the hospital was very proud of House Bill 4, I think, when the language was introduced. And in fact, they filed a supplemental petition for review based upon the language of House Bill 4, because I believe that the hospital thought that by amending the definitions of what was covered by House Bill 4 to include the words professional or administrative services, I believe that the hospital thought that House Bill 4 being clarified to legislate around the Rose v. Garland Community Hospital case to finally clarify that what they consider to be professional or administrative services, i.e. credentialing services, would indisputably and finally be covered by the Medical Practice Act. However, if this court is to give credence to the legislative intent of this bill, I would like to point to the Conference Committee report on House Bill 4 adopted which was published on June the 1st of 2003 in the Senate Journal. And I will tell you right now, I apologize. I had meant to make this an exhibit, but I'll tell you the state of being a poor trial lawyer in Texas. I got up here without the $25 I needed to make it an exhibit, but I believe that this will be an exhibit. Obviously, you all can find it, and I believe that it will be an exhibit to an amicus brief. In the Joint Committee report, Senator Hinojosa was making requests of Senator Ratliff, the proponent of House Bill 4, and asked him, on page 46, lines 8 through 13, there is a definition of professional or administrative services. Are claims involving those services automatically made health care liability claims? What about hiring a convicted felon or extending privileges to a drug-addicted physician or having a hazardous condition on your premises? And Senator Ratliff replied, no, those aren't made health care liability claims. Because if you look at the definition of health care and health care liability claims, the services must relate directly to the treatment of a particular patient. And none of the examples that you give would qualify. Judges, I believe that what this means is that House Bill 4 has been clarified to comport with definitions that did not change from the surviving example or the surviving 4590I statute, particularly the definition of health care liability claim. And I believe that what Justice Ratliff, presumably a senator who would be the most knowledgeable about how all-encompassing this statute was intended to be, was specifically made in the legislative intent published in the Senate Journal to not include non-medical decision-making such as negligent credentialing or extending privileges to, in this case, drug-addicted physician. In the case of our doctor, a physician who had 17 claims against him over a period of 4 or 5 years, who was a ear, nose, and throat specialist performing what he called cosmetic surgery, but what was really plastic surgery, which he should never have been allowed to perform in a hospital setting.
Let me try to understand this.
Yes, sir.
Case. Under the misguided decision in Agbor, you're still going to have to show malice against this hospital to recover.
And those are the sort of facts I'm telling you about that I think we can show it with.
But aren't you going to, even if not as a legal matter, as a practical matter of proof, need an expert witness to say 17 claims in 5 years is way over the... I mean, you know, from reading some of the press, you might think doctors got a malpractice claim against them every week or something. So, I mean, don't you need somebody with expert knowledge to put this in context anyway before you're ever going to have any chance of making this case?
Yes, and I think Mills tells us
so
we have to.
So what's the problem with lining that up and just complying with 4590I back at the outset,
well,
saving a few years?
We did. First of all, I would note that we did that. We had an expert who ultimately, I believe, rendered an opinion that comports with the good faith requirement outlined by this court in Palacios. And I want to make sure that we point that out to the court because the Court of Appeals did not address it. But also, ultimately, the question then becomes, I believe, can an expert at all within the first 90 or 180 days of a lawsuit, with presumably very, very little discovery done at that point, ever reach a professional opinion that there is, would this then mean that the expert report must outline that the conduct of the hospital was malicious in order to comply with both 4590I and the Texas Medical Practice Act? And is that ever going to be, as a practical purpose, possible from a litigant standpoint when he's got a lawsuit that is 90 or even 180 days old, when presumably many depositions have not been taken, full discovery has not been engaged in? The Texas Medical Practice Act is already out there to establish the bar that a negligent credentialing claim needs to get over. If we add the 4590I requirements, or now the Chapter 74 requirements, I think that the practical result will be that courts will find that these reports must include an expert opinion about malice, and that will practically do primarily to practical and procedural hurdles, write this cause of action out because it'll never be able to be made. And I don't think that that's what the courts have intended, and I don't think that's what the legislature intended.
Counsel, you acknowledge that expert testimony is required for negligent credentialing claim.
Mills tells us we have to have an expert.
Is that expert opinion a medical opinion or some other expert opinion?
I think that's the key to the difference between what is truly, I believe, should be governed by the Medical Practice Act, MLIIA, which is true medical decision making, and what is governed by something else. Because I would, in this case, for a credentialing claim, not choose a doctor, but rather choose a hospital administrator, a hospital risk manager, or even perhaps an insurance expert. Because the kind of decision that will be made in that credentialing committee and in the ombudsman process that Mr. Young has alluded to is not a medical decision. It's not, do we give another pint of blood? Do we perform the medical procedure? Is the doctor exercising good judgment? Is the doctor a drunk? Does the doctor have a claims history? And those are not medical decisions.
What if there are claims pending against a physician who seeks to be credentialed at a hospital and there's been no resolution of those claims, or just claims of medical negligence? Let's say there's 17, for example. No resolution, no determination, no settlement, no admissions, either way. And a hospital is considering credentialing that physician. Medical judgment required or not?
I think that that would be I would still, in that position, put up as my expert a risk manager. Because, I would say, what did the hospital do to ensure that that this doctor was exercising proper medical judgment? But I think that there'd have to be investigation that is risk management oriented rather than medical oriented, because I think that we'd want to know, are there other factors about this doctor that make him a risk?
So you're focusing on the quality of the review itself, what the credentialing committee is reviewing. And in doing that, are you rejecting this temporal element that the CA put forth? Because you'd have to admit that's problematic.
The Court of Appeals, I think, was, and I disagree with the petitioner in that that was the sole focus of their analysis. I merely think that they were trying to articulate or articulating the fact that these decisions are made, and they said at a different time, and I would say at a different time and in a different place, and using a different decision-making
criteria. But time and place don't matter so much based on the argument that you're making. In other words, the dividing line should be the quality or what is being assessed as opposed to when or where it's being assessed.
And temporal analysis is part of that. I guess the point that I'm trying to make is these are decisions that are made in boardrooms and in insurance offices and in administrators' offices and in ombudsman committees, and not at the bedside in the emergency room in the operating
room. But why would that matter? I mean, let's say it's a conference for a group of doctors or hospital administrators watching over to look at an x-ray and make a joint determination. So, where that takes place or when temporally it takes place doesn't matter so much as what it is, the essence of what they're doing.
And I agree with you. I mean, I think it's the essence of what they're doing, which is that they are making a risk analysis based upon, the kind of issues that risk management folks.
Well, and isn't that risk analysis different depending upon the nature of the injury? So, for example, if you have a serial rapist who's given credentials at a hospital who then rapes a patient, that would be a more clear demarcation of what would not be perhaps health care liability. Whereas if they're assessing the doctor's medical abilities, that would tend more towards the health care.
I agree. There are going to be a spectrum of decisions that some will, as you know, weigh more in on the medical decision-making process. You know, does this guy just use bad medical decision-making? I would urge more often, and certainly in Dr. Fowler's case, more often these decisions are on the other end of the spectrum, in that the doctor is using bad judgment in being arrested, failing to obtain medical liability insurance, failing to file his reports on time, failing to do the sorts of things that are different from medical decisions.
But to the extent credentialing depends upon assessment of the quality of care provided, you'd agree that it is more of a healthcare liability claim.
I agree in that it requires more analysis of medical decision making. However, again, it is a review process, an administrative process. It is one doctor saying, is the other doctor exercising sound medical decision making for the patient? It's not the doctor rendering treatment to the patient. It's a review process, an administrative process, and even though the criteria and the judgment used are more, in that case, akin to medical decision making for the original patient, I would assert to you that it's still one step back, and therefore is an administrative process, an analysis process that's different from rendering treatment and care to the patient.
But again, we have to look at our confines, seems to me, are the language of the statute. And I'm looking at what you allege. You said at least five different times that the hospital was grossly negligent or had malice because the doctor was reckless and careless in constituting a threat to the safety of his patients, and the hospital knew it or should have known it.
Right.
And then you go and look at the definition of expert report, and it seems to me that definition captures what you're alleging, essentially. But you're going to have an expert report within that definition of expert report to prove the allegations you've made.
I mean, I think that Mills tells us we have to have an expert report to get to the jury, and the expert, I mean, have to have expert testimony. And I know that we would have to have expert testimony. Whether or not that's it has to be in a report 90 days from the filing of the lawsuit is the sort of issue, I guess. Ultimately, after discovery and when we get ready to go to trial, we're going to have to disclose that there is an expert opinion, and we're going to have to disclose that there is evidence of that.
Again, going back to statute, it seems to me like you're claiming that there was a departure from accepted standards of health care.
Well, it depends on whether or not you're talking about yes and no. To me, health care, a standard of health care, involves medical decision making. Was the procedure done correctly? Did the personnel perform the procedure correctly? Were the proper...
What about safety? I mean, isn't it an aspect of accepted standards of safety if a physician was reckless and careless and constituted a threat to the safety of his patients, which you've alleged?
Again, to me, the safety that we're talking about in this particular language, I mean, it can be interpreted extremely broadly. I mean, if the court wanted to consider that the safety of doctors driving in the parking lot was an element of safety, then the court could conclude a car accident that happened in the hospital parking lot is a violation of the MLIIA that required an expert report on declaring that the doctor violated a rule of safety. I would urge a more restrictive definition that focuses the kind of safety we're talking about on safety related to medical decision making. Were the bed rails
up? Saying that he's not safe because he's careless and he constitutes a threat to medical decision making. Isn't that what you're alleging?
That and so much more with regard to this particular physician, and again with regard to lots of physicians that you could think of. I mean, there are the physicians whose safety record is indeed part and parcel and intimately intertwined with their medical decision making. But then there are also the physicians that you don't want in the operating room because they're serial rapists, or because they have narcolepsy, or because they are alcoholics, or, you know, for any other, their handshake, for any other number of reasons that perhaps don't deal with the physician's medical decision making. And I think that this physician, in particular, is just such an example whose medical decision making will be called into question, but also whose judgment in general will be called into question, and the hospital's knowledge of that will be part and parcel with our negligent credentialing claim.
But in order to be able to practice medicine at a hospital, a doctor has got to go through this process to prove that they're qualified to treat.
True.
And why is not the decision whether a doctor's qualified to treat an inseparable part of that analysis?
I would urge that, particularly with recredentialing claims, but also with... in order to get credentials the first time, you do have to show that you're licensed and that you're qualified. I agree that that is part of the application process, but it's not all of it. You also have to show that in most hospitals that you carry medical liability insurance, that you have a relatively free claims history, that in order to do the procedures that you are attempting to do in the hospital, that you have obtained the proper education, and that you have the proper continuing medical education credentials. For example, Dr. Fowler, an ear, nose, and throat specialist performing plastic surgery, when our expert says that it's malice to even allow a person who's an ear, nose, and throat surgeon to hold themselves out as a cosmetic surgeon. So I think that your analysis is right on, that part of it has to do with a question or a judgment about Vestal's medical decision-making, but so much more of it has to do with risk assessment and types of issues which don't have anything to do with treatment rendered to a particular patient, whether it's Debbie Rose or any other patient.
Where would you draw the line in 4590I cases? You started out by saying that this case involves mixed question of administrative and medical judgment. Appreciate that candor. Where along that continuum do you draw the line such that it can be replicated with predictability in Texas? consistent with the language of the statute, of course.
I think that an aspect of the court's the Court of Appeals temporal analysis ought properly to be a part of it, although not all of it. I think that it just has to be examined what type of decision is being made. Is it a decision being made on behalf of the patient, or is it an administrative decision that's being made in review, secondary, based on other factors?
You acknowledge that these decisions involve some of both. How much medical judgment is required before it's subject to 4590I? Or how little medical judgment is required before it does not involve 4590I? Where would you draw that line?
Well, I would think a credentialing decision is an easy one on the spectrum because credentialing committees never render treatment on behalf of the patient. I mean, I would think that some direct interaction with the patient has to be a part or an element of the criteria.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. They call it peer review for a reason. Reason is that the credentialing decision for a doctor is made by that doctor's peers. It is not made in the boardroom of the hospital or by the parent corporation or by an administrator. It is made by doctors. Those doctors make that decision by evaluating the physician's credentials and determining whether, in their medical judgment, he poses an unacceptable risk to the welfare of the future patients that he will treat.
So then, you reject that there's any kind of continuum and that hiring a serial murderer would be the type of decision that would not require an expert affidavit?
Because the decision is a medical decision made by doctors under a healthcare standard of care, I would say that's right. I think that's a pretty easy medical decision to make under those circumstances.
What if they credentialed a doctor or someone who purported to be a doctor who'd never been to medical school?
And they knew that fact? they would be required under AGVOR to have known that fact in order to predict. It may be that what
your question is, would you still disagree with the chief and say that that's still a medical judgment?
Here's what I'd say about that. It is still a medical judgment, just as it's a medical judgment to take out the wrong kidney. But just as there are classes of medical malpractice cases that do not require expert testimony because they are within the can of a lay jury, this might well be a situation that a lay juror could say there was improper credentialing going on here because I know enough as a lay person to know that.
So all credentialing decisions, right, wrong, neutral, are medical judgments under 4590I?
They are still medical judgments. They may not require expert testimony to prove them in the most obvious cases.
But an expert report would be required, in your opinion.
Under the terms of the statute, that's right. I don't think this court has faced a 4590I case against a physician for, let's say, taking out the wrong kidney, where an expert testimony is not going to be required at trial, and address whether, nevertheless, under 1301, an expert report is required. I think it'd be a reasonable construction to say, if you're not going to need expert testimony at trial, then you don't need an expert report pre-trial. But this court has never addressed that question.
So in this case, do you think we can say, as a matter of law, that the hiring of this physician was malicious, then we could dispense with the expert?
I can see that possibility. I'm not sure how the court ought to come out on whether 1301 requires a report, whether or not an expert testimony is going to be required to trial. Here, I think we know, both by the respondent's concession and by the facts of the case, that the judgment to credential Dr. Fowler was a medical judgment. The question was, did he have the skills that he needed to do the kind of things that he was doing? Did his track record show in the judgment of physicians that he was likely to commit improper acts in the future? All of those were clearly, even if you want to say that there is a spectrum, those were clearly on the medical part of the spectrum and not the taking out of the wrong kidney part of the spectrum. So that decision was indeed a healthcare decision made by the physician. There is no requirement that treatment or health care require direct interaction with the patient. If there were, no radiologist would ever be liable.
The Court of Appeals did not address the quality of the affidavit under 4590I because it held it wasn't a health care liability claim. And the plaintiff has alleged that their affidavit is sufficient to sustain the case under 4590I, fact for the court's decision. Do you claim that the affidavit is defective because of the failure to address malice? Is that the reason you claim it's defective?
No,
or does it in fact, I haven't seen it. Does it in fact address malice?
It does not address malice.
Is that why you claim it's defective?
Yes, in part. And it does not reflect a deviation from the standard of care by the hospital. It is devoted to the proposition that Dr. Fowler is an incompetent physician. That is not the standard of care for a credentialing committee. The credentialing committee is supposed to do whatever investigation the standard of care requires to determine whether someone is an incompetent physician. There's no expression of an expert opinion about whether they did or didn't do the things the credentialing committees are supposed to do.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument. In the second clause, we'll take another brief recess. All rise.